The Secret Fire Podcast and the Great Commission Transmission Network is made possible by the support of listeners like you.
To learn more and to partner with us, visit us at gctnetwork.com/donate.
Gandalf, my old friend, this will be a night to remember.
Hail and well met. This is Michael from the Secret Fire Podcast, and we have a very special episode for you today. Last week, we failed to inform you that Brendan, Micah, and I were not going to be in the studio this week. We have some local events that we're all involved in, which we're very excited about, and we'll tell you a little bit about those next time. But I didn't want to leave you without a witness. I don't like to skip a week of the Secret Fire Podcast, and I know many of you don't like it either. So in lieu of a normal show, I want to take you back in time to the old, now defunct, Middle Earth Network. I ran the radio station over there, and some of you may remember all the different shows we produced, such as the Founders Inklings and Middle Earth Network specials. We had some incredible guests and some fantastic conversations. For this special episode, I want to share an interview we did with noted scholar Tom Shippey. Tom is a professor of Middle and Old English, as well as medievalism and modern fantasy and science fiction. He is considered one of the leading scholars of the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien, and his knowledge of Beowulf is incredible. I don't remember the exact date of this interview, but I'm pretty sure it originally aired live on Middle Earth Network Radio in January of 2012. So join me and the other founders of Middle Earth Network, Mark Ostley, Tyler Michael Johnson, and John D. Bartolo of the Lonely Mountain Band for a visit with Professor Tom Shippey.
Well, we have a very special guest with us today, all the way from across the pond, a scholar in his own right, Dr. Tom Shippey from, is it still Leeds?
No, hasn't been Leeds for a long time. Right now I'm associated with the University of Winchester.
We're very honored to have you, Dr. Shippey, and we want to talk to you and have our listeners get to know you a little bit better.
Good. Thanks very much.
Tom, did you teach in St. Louis?
Yes, that's right. When I left Leeds in 1993, I went across to St. Louis, and I stayed there till 2008. And then I retired, though I'm still an emeritus at St. Louis, and came back to England. And I'm now living in Dorsetshire, which is a county which has no significant university presence. So I go across to the University of Winchester in the next county. Use their library, and I do some things for them, and they give me library privileges.
Let's back up just a little bit, because I find it fascinating. It's reported that you were born in India.
Yes, that's right. Yes, of parents born in India. So I tell you what, I had real trouble getting a passport when I first applied. You know, the British authority said, "Well, you know, where's your birth certificate?" And I said, "Well, I'm afraid it's been eaten by termites," and that didn't go down too well. So I very nearly became a stateless person at that point.
And also, is it correct your father was in the bridge building trade?
That's right. He was an engineer, specialist bridge builder, and actually specialized in high steel welding.
It sounds very similar to Tolkien's life, early life as well.
In some ways, yes. Of course, he came back to Britain much younger than I did, but I went through a more standard routine, which was usually you got sent home back at the age of seven. And the reason they sent you back at the age of seven is because if they sent you back any later, you wouldn't learn English properly.
Right.
So actually, when I was seven, I think I remember, I was told that one of my female relatives, you know, I was put to stay with for a bit, she reported, she said in her thick northeast accent, she said, he's a cunny man, talks all the time, kind of understand a word he says.
Wonderful.
It was a shock to me to find that people couldn't speak Hindi. I don't know. Where am I?
And not only that, but in several ways, and part of the program we're devoting to people that knew even mildly J.R. Tolkien, but your professional career, your academic career, mirrored his in several ways.
Yes, that's right. That was sheer coincidence as it happens, but on several occasions, on at least three occasions, I found myself living, just a couple of streets from where Tolkien lived or had lived. So both in Birmingham and in Leeds and in Oxford, I was very, very familiar with what had been his surroundings.
How did you find yourself with an interest in Old English?
Wow, that goes so far back, I'm not sure I can remember. I was certainly interested in it, pre-teen. And King Edward School, Birmingham, which I went to, and which, of course, Tolkien went to, if there's one thing it was good at, actually, it was languages. So even at school, I found on the shelves there the Anglo-Saxon primer, which had been the standard textbook ever since Tolkien's time, and I just started reading that by myself. So this kind of thing was encouraged. So it was very easy to pick things up like that. I mean, I think among Tolkien's earliest publications were Old English Riddles. Which he'd made up. But then, so were mine, actually. I think my first publication may well have been an Old English Riddle, which came out in the King Edward School Chronicle.
I hope
no one ever finds it, because I'm pretty sure now that I got the scansion wrong. But that's because I was self-educated and didn't know these things. But that goes back a long way.
Okay, then if I could sneak in one personal question here. My son is 12 years old, and he fancies himself a Tolkienologist. He wants to be a Tolkien professor in his own right. And I keep telling him, follow the languages. And he has an interest in, he says, you know what, Dad, I can look at a particular language and probably tell which race it came from, speaking within the context of Middle Earth. And so for somebody, a youngster like that, 12 years old, how would you recommend that they start out learning about Old English or Middle English or...
Well, there's a long history of giving bad advice here. Oh, you remember Joseph Wright, who was Tolkien's professor, told him when he was an undergraduate, he said, Joe Wright also had a thick northern accent, he said, go into Celtic Lad, there's money in it. And in fact, he was dead wrong about that. And Tolkien didn't really follow the advice anyway. But, of course, there are many languages one could start on, but these days there are the standard textbooks like my old sweet Anglo-Saxon primer, but there's also distance learning now. I'm sure that they have Old English lessons online, and I think also that they will now be not just print and paper, there'll be audio assistance as well. And that, I think, makes a great deal of difference.
Yes.
Now, I can't actually say, what the website is that you would find. I know one of my students was developing one of these systems, so I could find out. But I should think if you... I'll tell you what I'd do. I would actually Google Michael Drought. That's Drout. He, of course, is the editor of the Tolkien Encyclopedia. But I know that he's put a great deal of Old English online, audio. So I think if you poked around, what he's put online, you would probably have a very good start.
Well, I thank you for that advice. John, you have a little bit of a affinity for Old English and such.
Yeah, absolutely. It's especially when it relates to Beowulf. And I would like to ask Tom Shippey my own personal question. When did you first encounter Beowulf? Was it before school, before official schooling, or can you talk?
These are all questions that take me so far back. I'm just trying to think. Well, I know that. I think I actually find it. Actually, hang on a second. I'm just walking across to my bookshelves because I have here R.W. Chambers' Beowulf: An Introduction, third edition with supplement by C.L. Wren. Tolkien, of course, was a friend of Chambers and was succeeded by Wren. And I'm pretty sure I got that as a prize. And I see it is the King Edward School Lightfoot Shakespeare Prize awarded to me in 1960.
Wow.
So in 1960, I hadn't just read Beowulf, I was reading the main, shall we say, scholarly introduction to it. So that's, how long ago is that? 51 years, maybe 52. And as I say, I'd obviously started before that, or I wouldn't have picked the book as a prize. Hang on, I'm still poking around my bookshelves. Let me just haul down my first edition of Lord of the Rings, because I'm sure I've got that as a prize. And the reason I had to get that as a prize is because it was so darned expensive.
Wow.
You know, I couldn't afford to buy it myself. And the local library, very annoyingly, had Volume 1 and Volume 3, but not Volume 2. And I didn't want to start reading if I was going to miss the middle. Yeah, here's my first edition. And what does it say? King Edward School, B Block Form Prize, Modern Language Division, me, signed by the Chief Master in 1959.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's taking us back to the late 50s.
I'm related to that. Then I have another question which should take you back. The year of my birth... From what I understand, is in 1972 you met Tolkien.
That's right. It must have been 1972 because he died in early in 1973, and I didn't get to Oxford until whatever it was, something like October 72. So I must have been talking to him in the last few months of his life, which of course I didn't know.
Do you remember that first meeting?
Oh, yeah, sure. It wasn't entirely unexpected because we'd been in correspondence before. He kind of knew I was coming, and I knew I was going to go over and meet him, which I would have done anyway as a kind of new member of the faculty. His successor, Norman Davis, took me over to meet him, and we had dinner at Merton College, where Tolkien, after the death of his wife, was living as a sort of, I won't say as a pensioner, but living as a sort of protege of the college. And Merton College, of course, is famous for its dinners, a very high level of catering there. So that was a very welcome event all round. But, I now realize, of course, that I missed several major opportunities there. I mean, just to be brutally materialistic, you know, here I am, I got this boxed set of the first edition of Lord of the Rings here, of course, I shouldn't have gone around reading it, because that sort of puts wear and tear on it,
yes.
And I should have kept the box in much better condition, shouldn't I?
Yes.
And I should have got Tolkien to sign it.
Wow.
Yeah. All that, you know, my retirement fund would look a great deal better, wouldn't it?
That's what a clever dragon would have done.
I just can't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I'm just amazed that we are, along with all the listeners, are going on a virtual tour of Tom Shippey's library. How about that?
Now that sounds like an idea for a podcast.
There you go. In fact, that might be
a virtual tour of Tom
I believe
Shippey's.
That's the title of this podcast. You did what was it in about 1970 or so, and you did a lecture Tolkien as a philologist.
Yeah. It was at the Pebble Mill Art Center in Birmingham, and Tolkien by 1970 was, already pretty well known, in fact, more than that, I think, and the organizers decided it would be a good idea to have a day of talks on Tolkien. So they called up four people to give talks on various ologies, and search me if I can remember what they were. Philosophy, I dare say, sociology, I'm pretty sure. There was another one, and then there was me at the end doing philology. But, of course, nobody knew what philology meant. Also, this was 1970, and, we'd been having a lot of trouble, actually. 1968 was the big year of student revolutions. So as a very junior lecturer, I'd had a lot of trouble trying to keep things going in lectures. Anyway, I turned up to this day at Pebble Mill, and I must say, I hope that nobody concerned is listening, but the first three lectures were way off the point. They were given by people who didn't actually know anything about Tolkien, and who were really sort of putting in a plug for whatever their subject was, and the audience was starting to head for the doors by the time I got up. But as I say, I was quite used to rebellious students, and I told them all to sit straight back down, and I fixed them with a glittering eye, and I said I was going to tell them what Tolkien was really interested in.
Wow.
And nobody better leave. And anyway, this went down very well. And Tolkien's secretary was in the audience, Joy Hill, and she took, you know, those days, of course, it was there were no computers. What I got was a typescript and a carbon. And she took my carbon off to show to the professor, who'd been poorly, of course. Otherwise, he had intended to come. And he liked it and sent me a letter about it. And I think he liked the fact that it was all happening in Birmingham,
yes,
to which he remained, you know, deeply attached. And, of course, he also, for obvious personal reasons, was deeply attached to King Edward School. It had been the stable element in his life all the time he was a child and a teenager. So he was, should we say, he was predisposed in favor of anybody who came from the old school.
Did you know that Joy Hill was there?
No, I didn't know anything about. I didn't know what was going on, really. I just turned up with my script, ready to deliver it.
So what did you think when she?
That at all.
What was it like when she approached you?
Well, I think I was, as I recall, as I said, it's a long time ago. I think I was a bit flustered. You know, there were a lot of people milling around, and I wasn't quite sure who anybody was.
Yes.
And I think I really sort of said, oh, yeah, sure, okay, yes, I got a spare copy, and passed it over and didn't think anything about it, really, until I got a letter from Tolkien.
And if I can ask, what were your impressions of him as an individual and as a person?
Again, this perhaps explains why I did not make the best of my opportunities, but my impression when I met him was that he was kind of wary and cautious. You know, he'd been interviewed too often, and many of the interviewers, of course, had no idea what they were talking about, and they're also likely to, garble what he said, or even, you know, I think in some cases, make fun of it. So, you know, he didn't want any of that stuff. And I felt it was a good idea not to go interrogating him, because that had happened too often already. So we really had a kind of very Hobbit-style conversation, you know, about, he was actually, strangely enough, he was really quite interested in the rugby team. Back in those days, Old Edwardians, that's the team of the alumni of the school, it was quite a big team, actually, nationally. And he just wanted to know what was going on and talk about the fixture list. And he actually had me run through the team members. Hmm. And he was quite interested in that because he had a guy called Peter Neave. And he said, Peter Neave. And, of course, I now realize that's because it was his Aunt Jane's name. And he was trying to figure out if Peter was a cousin of his. Which, you know, is not at all impossible because it was a very kind of stable community with, you know, with children and grandchildren and coming back generation after generation. So it's quite likely that I was associating with, you know, his younger cousins. So and then we got on to discussing the name. And the other thing about Tolkien, well, one of the other things about Tolkien is he was just fascinated by names. So he asked me what I thought Neave meant. And I said, well, I suppose it's a nickname originally, and I suppose it's from Old Norse knevi, fist. And he said, yes, it could be, but, and then he came up with another explanation, which I think was very, again, very personal to him. But I know he did that with all sorts of people, actually. Yeah. I met other people who'd known Tolkien and who had discussed the etymology of their own names with him. I think it's true to say that Tolkien is the only person I ever met who could actually get hours of fun out of the telephone directory.
You know, actually, Tom, there's a interesting bit of current news, actually, that we were perhaps hoping you could shed some light on. Don't know if you've heard of this, but just within the news in the last 24 to 48 hours here, there's been some talk of the Nobel Prize Committee from back in 1961 when the Lord of the Rings books were nominated for that prize. And some of the you know, jury files have now been lifted from, you know, this archive, so to speak. And, you know, basically how you were mentioning just a moment ago that the professor was almost kind of sick and tired of having his work being dismissed and you know, things of this nature. Apparently, the committee felt the same way at the time. You know, I mean, one of the quotes that I'm reading here from this article saying that how, and this is in reference to the books, the result has not in any way measured up to storytelling of the highest quality, which, you know, now obviously looking back is kind of a laughable notion. But had you heard of this or how,
yeah,
I mean,
yes,
what are your feelings?
And I'm afraid I just dismissed it, saying, oh, well, you know, the history of people, you know, writing Tolkien off, goes back to the moment of publication, actually. So,
but why do you think?
Surprised.
I mean,
can I tell you a really good put down I heard once?
Sure.
On a program a bit like this, I was on a phone in, and one of the other participants was Ursula Le Guin, you know, the famous fantasy author, author of the Earthsea books. And we also had, of course, another, what I would call rather rudely, a kind of renter professor, somebody that they'd hauled in. And he said all this kind of thing. He said, oh, Tolkien, we can't take Tolkien seriously. I mean, the man just can't write. I mean, the man just can't write sentences. So that's actually what he said. And when he'd finished, the MC turned to Ursula Le Guin and said, have you anything to say about that, Ms. Le Guin? And she said, very much grande dame, you know, she, looking down her nose, so to speak. She said, oh, no, she said, you can't argue with incapacity. And I said, oh, yeah, right. That told him where to get off. The other thing I'd say, perhaps more more intellectually, is that there is a kind of ideological divide here, which goes back again a long way. And I would put it, this is putting it very, very simply, but I would say that, you know, way back, more than 100 years ago, say before, just before Tolkien was born, we had a kind of established classical novel tradition, which was also calling itself, you know, modernism, and which was devoted to what it saw as modernity. But at the same time, there were people writing what they themselves called the New Romance. And the authors of the New Romance were people like Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote Treasure Island, or Conan Doyle, who invented Sherlock Holmes, or Rider Haggard, who wrote King Solomon's Mines, and a string of other successors, and Rudyard Kipling, I'd say, as well, and indeed Bram Stoker with Dracula. These are the authors of the New Romance, and you know, none of them really ever got into the syllabus of English departments. They were always dismissed as being not serious, not proper novelists, just entertainers. But, you know, what is it that powers our modern films and images and video games and indeed sequels? How many sequels have there been to Sherlock Holmes, for goodness sake? If you want a kind of a crossover fiction, you've got, the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen,
yep,
which is staffed by the characters of the people I just mentioned.
Yes.
Right.
So Tolkien, really, you might say, was a late arrival in what you might call the New Romance. And, of course, these people have always been regarded as not properly academic, not our sort, I think is what they say. So on the one side, you've got someone like Virginia Woolf or E.M. Forster, and on the other, you've got people like Robert Louis Stevenson and Tolkien. And, you know, the supporters of one side do not get on with the supporters of the other. But it's the supporters of the, you know, the old classical mode who make the decisions about Nobel Prizes. You're not going to get a good review from people like them.
I think it boils down to a philosophical and worldview divide, yes, when it gets right down to it. And I think that's why the modern writers dismiss the romantic writers. And that's probably what's happening when you're talking about the Nobel Prize and things of that nature.
But it's also a contest, you might say, or a clash between elite culture and mass culture. And elite culture, I think, tends to think that mass culture is, you know, sub-intellectual and really written for people who are not too bright or immature or whatnot, or not very well-read.
Barbarians.
Say, you know, let's have a debate. I don't mind, but see who's better read, me or you. prepared to put $100 on me any day. Okay, so yes, never mind the Nobel Prize. They usually give it to some flaming Scandinavian anyway.
Well said. Well, and speaking of great literature, I mean, you're prolific in writing essays, papers, editing, but some of your own books. The Road to Middle-Earth, well, going way back, I think, to 1972, Old English Verse. And
there's as many copies of that kicking around.
It should come back into print. I think there's a renaissance coming about for some of this type of literature. It's about time, too. But The Road to Middle-Earth,
right.
You also are author of J.R.R. Tolkien, Author of the Century, and quite a few other books. What's in store for the future? Anything that we can look forward to the future from you? Or?
Perhaps I should just say that I've also been a science fiction fan for almost as long as I've been a Tolkien reader, possibly longer. I've been associated with the writer Harry Harrison for a long, long time as well. So half a dozen of his books are really sort of co-authored by me.
And you used the pseudonym John Holm, if I'm...
Yeah, that's right. That's it. We had to think of something, and that's what came up. The Hammer and the Cross, I think, I had a lot to do with that.
Oh, wow.
And it's two sequels. So Harry, I should say, is in pretty bad way now, and I'm just waiting for more news of him, but I won't say any more about that. Things doing in the future? Well, I've always wanted to write a book, and indeed I've half-written it. Which I call How the Heroes Talk. And it's a study of the way conversation is carried on in the early heroic literatures of Old English, Old Norse, Old High German, Old Saxon. And the short answer to How the Heroes Talk is, briefly, they don't say a word more than necessary. Indeed, in many cases, they say a lot fewer words than necessary. So it's deliberately hard to make out. And I don't think people have been very good at making it out, and I wanted to kind of correct this. And of course, I could say that one of the many things you can say about Tolkien is he was very good at that too. A lot of heroic speech is proverbial, but an awful lot of The Lord of the Rings is proverbial. Mm-hmm. If you try to count how many kind of proverbs there are in there, well, I've forgotten, but I made it over 70. I made a list of them once, and I expect there are some I've missed. Now, some of those proverbs are genuinely old ones, which he's just translated, and some of them are ones which he's made up, and some of them I'm not sure about. But it's a bit like the riddles, you know, in The Hobbit. Some of those are ancient ones, and some of them are ones Tolkien made up or picked up from contemporary life. But he was very good at mixing the one and the other.
We have somebody in the chat room that's asking another question. Is it true? Are you going to be attending the Return of the Ring conference?
Yes, that's right. It's in Loughborough in the East Midlands in England in August, and I certainly will be there, God willing. Yeah.
Any kind of a preview or a hint of what you will be speaking about?
No, because I've got to. I was talking to myself the other day and saying, I've got to find a new subject because I think most of my themes are terribly well known to everybody, and I've got to think of something new to say.
What about a preview to How the Heroes Talk?
Well, that's a thought, certainly. That's a thought. I could pick up on the proverbial stuff and just show how he uses it.
I would love for you to finish that book because I want to read it.
Yes, I've got to get on with it. But one of the things that keeps me distracted is that I write a column in the Wall Street Journal about fantasy and science fiction, which of course has been my great hobby for all my adult life. So I'm just staring around my office again and looking at all the books I'm supposed to read and review by next Tuesday or whatever it is. There's quite a lot of them. Some of them are dauntingly big as well, you know. Nowadays, the publishing fashion in fantasy is for great big doorstopper books. Sometimes I wish they'd send me some nice little short ones, like The Hobbit, maybe. But they don't do that anymore.
How do you feel about modern technology in its relation to literature and the propagation of it? Or, electronic books, the ability for us to do this type of thing over the internet and discuss literature.
Well, really, I'm all in favor of nearly all of it. I think, kind of looking round. I've got my Kindle sort of sitting over there. It's very easy to download stuff. I also go online. I mean, I'm living 70 miles from a library, you know. But if I go online, I can actually access all kinds of heavyweight academic books, which not every library has. If I couldn't get them online, I'd have to go to London or maybe Oxford. And to tell the truth, it might be easier for me to go to Dublin.
Well,
sure, it's a copyright library, but as it happens, I can, if I get myself sorted out, I can actually check them here. So that's a great advantage, and I think will become a greater advantage as time goes by and they get more stuff digitized.
Well, we're running short of time, and as I said, Tom, I know it's late over in the UK there. One thing, and I don't know, you certainly don't have to say yes, but even the first couple lines out of Beowulf, I don't know if you can repeat those from memory.
Absolutely.
But oh, that would be wonderful.
Gosh, just unless I get stage fright or something, but I think we can manage that. What way gardena on your dalgum feod kuninga, fum your funon, who the athlingas, Ellen Fremadon, off chill shaving, sharena fertum monicum make from meodu settler off there, exeter aorla. Now, people who have been listening carefully, and I don't know how many of those are there, will notice that I have made an emendation to line 6, which is not in standard texts. But that emendation, well, I don't know who thought of it first, but I thought of it, and I found out from Michael Drought quite recently that Tolkien actually approved it, because I changed the standard text reading of Eorlas, which means warriors, to Eorla, which means the tribe of the Eruli. And I'm suggesting that, as very often, the scribes of the Beowulf manuscript did not recognize proper names. But if you fill in the proper names or you understand them properly, then actually the Beowulf poet turns out to know a great deal about what was going on in a very dark period. So in some ways, Beowulf is another book of lost tales. But I hope that we can re-excavate some of them. And that's one thing that I'm working on, actually, for a collection which is coming out from Harvard later this year.
Wow.
That is... I'll tell you what.
I would like to have a whole, Mark, a whole episode with Tom just on Beowulf.
I have done a couple of lectures on Beowulf for Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor. That's how you'll find him. If you Google the Tolkien professor, all one word, Corey's stuff will pop up there. And I did two online lectures for his Mythgard Institute, I think it was last September. So actually, and both of them were about Beowulf. So actually, I think they're probably still online.
You may not know this, Tom, but we here at the Middle Earth Network are co-founders of the Mythgard Institute.
Of the Mythgard Institute.
Yes.
Well, in that case, you should be able to get a password off of it. That's what
I was there for those lectures, Tom, and they were brilliant. As a matter of fact, I asked one of the questions that you answered. Very helpfully about the sword, the giant sword on the wall in Grendel's mother's cave.
Yes, that's right. Yep. Yes. Oh well, good. So I'm glad you were there, and I haven't checked to see if they're still online, but I suspect they are.
They are all still available online, and I know that several people came away from the course that you taught just. I think it was all over the Twitter and Facebook communities for some time. So
yes, I've been keeping an eye on the kind of daily forum that the Mythgard Institute puts out, and seeing, of course, they've now gone on to discussing many more things, including the Kalevala, and much more about Tolkien's own works. But yeah, it seems to be a very successful course, and I hope it will be repeated.
We've great hopes, and I think what Corey's done over there has just been absolutely much needed, and I think it's going to continue to grow. So,
yeah, that's right. Every advantage. I mean, I won't put out too much of a plug for it, but it struck me straight away. Corey can kind of call people from all over the world, which wouldn't have been possible otherwise, and the cost of it are so much lower that the students end up getting a very good deal as well.
That's correct. Well, Dr. Shippey, we thank you again for your time. We're gonna have to leave now and let you, I suppose, get to your evening, the rest of your evening, and to a good night's sleep. But I cannot tell you how honored all of us and the listeners are listening right now to have had you come over for the interview.
Well, thanks very much. I'll go and put all these books back on the shelves now.
Right. And we will keep dreaming about having our own copies of those. All right, friends, you have been listening to...
Thanks very much, and good evening.
Oh, good evening to you, sir. Everybody, you've been listening to a Middle Earth Network special. Again, it was the perfect time for us to gather and to speak with Tom Shippey. What a great conversation that we had. This will be available as a podcast here probably by the end of the afternoon here. I'm pretty excited to get this one up on the streams. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, very much.
Yeah. Definitely. My only complaint, as always, it just goes too quickly.
It does. It does. But that's when you're having great conversation, that's usually the case, isn't it? Especially when you are having a pipe of old Toby here, provided by a Lonely Mountain Band in the background, as all of you can hear.
Oh, a wonderful plug, as always.
What a wonderful man Tom is. Simply delightful. How about him teasing us with his first edition of The Lord of the Rings? Yes, he just had to move that out of the way in order to get to his other books. I'll tell ya, I really enjoyed revisiting this interview. And I had a great time with Mark, Tyler, and John, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. If you did, let me know, because I have many other interviews with people who are near and dear to the world of J.R.R. Tolkien, and I'll be happy to share them on future special episodes of the Secret Fire Podcast. Iluvatar Willing and the Bruinen Don't Rise will be back next week to continue our journey through The Lord of the Rings and the Council of Elrond. As always, we're live in the studio broadcasting video on our Twitch channel at twitch.tv/secretfirepodcast. Follow us on Twitter, where we'll announce when the cameras are on at Secret Firecast. Send all email to secretfire@gctnetwork.com. And help us keep the Secret Fire Podcast going by supporting the show and the GCT Network at patreon.com/GCTN. That's patreon.com/GCTN. Any amount helps. Subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app by searching for Secret Fire Podcast. And above all, share the show with a friend. Sharing is caring after all, and this would be a great episode to share. And until next time...
I regret to announce this is the end. I'm going now. I bid you all a very fond farewell.
Tuned in to the GCT Network.
This is your Great Commission.
This is your Great Commission transmission.
At gctnetwork.com.